Well, usually my sermons try to make sense of a biblical text. But what do I do when I start with a text that makes no sense? No logic, no rationality. Let me just say it. Today's story is nonsense. In a good way, I think. At least I hope I can convince you of that till the end. This miracle at Cana defies logic. And I don't mean the actual miracle of turning water into wine. That's the least of my worries. How does this strange miracle begin to fit with Jesus' mission? We know from every gospel that his mission is to proclaim God's kingdom, a kingdom of raising ethical standards, turning the other cheek, loving enemies, going the second mile, healing people, overcoming evil and oppression, welcoming the outcast, touching lepers, and yes, even raising the dead. So one would think that for Jesus' first miracle, the first public exercise of his power to usher in God's kingdom, that he might do something more, well, useful for the kingdom than turning water into wine. Not to be anti-wine, of course, but no one at this wedding, as far as we know, was healed by Jesus. No one had their sins forgiven. No one was cured of blindness. No one was given words of wisdom about the kingdom. But they did have plenty of wine. And adding to the nonsense, why was Jesus' mother so worried about the wine shortage that she felt responsible as a guest to fix it? And pressure Jesus into playing his God card? Maybe she thought Jesus' Messiah clock was ticking at age 30 and he should move out of the house and start getting to work. Like some other 30-year-old sons, Jesus did not receive his mother's advice very kindly. He got a little attitude in verse 4, and I paraphrase, "Mom, it's not your business. And it's not mine either. Let's just stay out of it." So Mary stepped right into the Jewish mother stereotype, ignored Jesus, went to the servants, and said, "Okay, I got it all worked out. Jesus will take care of everything. Just do whatever he tells you." And Jesus caved. Is this gospel story or is it comedy? A nonsense narrative. And then the miracle itself is almost cartoonish. 6 30-gallon jars, that's about a third of the size of those jars. I mean, sure, this was a big party and all, but Jesus made out of water nearly 180 gallons of wine. This was after everyone already drank all the wine the wedding planners anticipated they would drink. 180 more gallons of not ordinary wine, but fine wine. I'm with the steward here. The wine steward objected to the groom when he tasted the wine. Why now? Everyone's already tipsy. They can't even appreciate this. So what's the point here, Jesus? Why this miracle? I'm not the first person to wonder this. I'm in good company. In 400 AD, St. Augustine wondered about it. Of course, he came up with an answer that made sense to him. The 6 water jars signified the 6 ages, from Adam to Noah, Noah to Abraham, Abraham to David, from David to the exile, from exile to John the Baptist, and from John the Baptist to the present age. Six. A perfect six. Augustine further explained that each age was an empty vessel until it was fulfilled in Christ. Augustine even took several pages to explain that the capacity of the jars, 30 gallons, signified the Holy Trinity. Okay. Others have also tried to make sense of this, like leaving the best wine till last means the real rewards of life come only after Christ has transformed us. I don't know. That's cute and all, but I'm not buying it. This is a story about Jesus and what he did in real life. Nothing wrong with finding symbolism here. If you like it, go for it. But I want to know why John put this story in his narrative. Well, John tells us why. The gospel writer says in verse 11, and I quote, "Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Ah, okay. A little aside here. You see, John explains near the end of the gospel that the reason for writing the whole book is, quote, "that you might believe that Jesus is the Son of God and believing have life in his name." Belief for John does not mean agreeing with a rational proposition about Jesus. No, John means belief in one's gut. John wants us to be wowed by Jesus, to be taken by, to be seized by the truth of Jesus' union with God, so that being seized by this beautiful truth, it takes over our own lives and we end up living the life we were made to live. The goal is not completing a checklist of doctrines. The goal is full life. John says in 100 different ways in this book that the God who created you with a word, the Logos, who spoke the word world into being, who filled your lungs with breath, who filled your heart with rhythm, that is the very same God that you meet in Jesus. So we can expect every well-told story in this book to point in that direction, to seize you with wonder and awe and trust in Jesus, who is God in the flesh. So going back to this story, does it work? Absolutely. This story is not supposed to make sense. When we are told a story that makes sense, we might nod our head or quietly say, "Ah, yeah." Stories that make sense help us understand things. This is not that kind of story. It's not meant to make sense. It's meant to seize us, to get us in our gut, to motivate us to put our trust in Jesus. These stories early in the book, John calls them signs. Signs. A sign is not the main thing. It points to the main thing. The glory of God that shows up in Jesus through a miracle at a poorly managed wedding in the town of Cana does to us what it did to those wedding guests. Like nearly all of Jesus' miracles, it catches us off guard. It throws us off balance and shows us there's something bigger going on here than what we can see right in front of our faces. Miracles were signs pointing to a bigger thing. It was never Jesus' intent to heal every sick person in the Middle East, or wipe out leprosy, or poverty, or blindness, or argue his case so well that everyone became a disciple. No, Jesus was sent to be a sign of God's reign, a foretaste of the kingdom, a witness to what God was doing in the larger cosmos. And the best way to do that was catch people's attention somewhere other than in their gray matter, on the left side of their brain. The gospel is not entirely rational. We need to be willing to be seized by the gospel, to open up our defenses, to let ourselves be knocked off our feet by God's glory. Glory. Glory is what moves us. Glory and good sense both have their place. But if we want movement, if we want motivation, all-out commitment, and risk-taking sacrifice, I'll put my money on glorious before I do sensible. Why do we all get a little giddy at the sight of new fallen snow, like we did twice this past week, or run to the porch every time a rainbow appears, or hike up a mountain to the same overlook, sometimes week after week, year after year? No, not because we finally figured out how snowflakes form in the atmosphere and stick to branches, or how sun rays get bent by water droplets and turn all kinds of colors, or how the layout of the valley can be plotted on a map. No, we do those things because they put us in touch with glory. Glory grabs us by the heart and moves us. We can't help but smile at the snowscape, run to see the rainbow, and pound our body into submission to make it to the peak, because the reward is simply glorious. This story in John 2 ends by saying what the miracle did. It revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. See, a few had already begun to follow Jesus around with curiosity, with an open mind, hoping Jesus might fulfill their expectations of a Messiah. But this miracle at the wedding threw them off balance. This irrational, unexplainable, superfluous, and extravagant demonstration of the power of God hit them like 180 gallons of wine. God was doing something beyond their ability to imagine. God was doing something that called their assumptions into question. And at the same time, it made them say to Jesus, "We're in." That's what God's glory will do to us when it shows up. It knocks us off balance. It makes us take notice. It makes us believe something we previously wouldn't have dared to believe. Maybe some nonsense like we find in this story, is how we get to see glory. How we sit up and take notice. How we realize that the world as it is not necessarily the world as it can be if we throw our lot in with Jesus. With Jesus, we need not settle for the way things are. We need not look around and say, this must be as good as it gets. This gospel story is good news for everyone in the world for whom the wine has run out, so to speak. It's good news for anyone suffering from the way things are. Those grieving loss of loved ones. Those hanging on to the edge of exhaustion. Those who feel alone in the world. Those who believe their fate is sealed and nothing is going to change. Those afraid to walk away from an abusive relationship. You name the way your wine has run out. Here in John 2, we meet in Jesus the God of glory, the God who does the unexpectedly beautiful thing. Mother Mary was not expecting what Jesus actually did. I suspect Mary wanted Jesus to do a little something to help the host save face, to make things stretch until the party winded down. A little extra cheap wine in the vats would have been perfect. What happened instead was a bit of nonsense. Over the top, extravagant, excessive, beautiful, and glorious. It caused the first disciples to move from being the curious to being the committed. May God's glory today, wherever it shows up, do the same for us.